You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
There's a problem at the House of Representatives in December 1839 as they try to begin the 26th Congress, and that's nobody is saying anything. The Congress is not organized. The people's representatives are here, they're in the Capitol, and they speak for the public, but they can't because there's no speaker. No one is presiding, no one has the gavel. And that's because the clerk of the House wouldn't begin the roll call, wouldn't allow them to organize the Congress. It's all because of a situation, and I'm sorry to say, it's New Jersey's fault.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
After the most recent midterms, mostly held in 1838, midterms weren't held on one day at that time, the Whig Party has crept up on the Democratic Party. I mean, there's unpopularity with this president, Martin Van Buren, who is a Democrat, and the economy, the price of things. But in New Jersey, there's a disputed election. The Whigs claim that they have the congressional seats, and the Democrats claim that they have congressional seats. In this case, New Jersey has no election districts. There's no congressional districts. There's just one slate. Governor William Pennington makes the decision that the Whigs have won. He is a Whig. Now it gets to Congress, and whichever one is seated, that's the party that will have the majority of the House of Representatives. So this New Jersey squabble becomes a national issue. Well, the Congress says you may have the governor of New Jersey, Whigs, but we, the Democrats, have the clerk of the House. The clerk is a Democrat. He's going to hold up seating the new Congress. He just simply will not do the roll call at all. The old Congress is Democratic anyway. He can only lose by seating these New Jersey Whigs. Plus, there's a lot of suspicion about some of the voting in the state. 3 days pass, and there's no organization of the 26th Congress, yet they all show up. And all Clerk Garland does is simply refuse to start the roll call. He has opened the Congress, but he refuses to start the roll call. Whigs now see that Garland is following a script, working for the Democrats, except there's a problem. The whole Congress is sitting here waiting. And what do they think? Their whole strategy is based on the fact that the Whigs will just maybe walk away? Give up? Well, it could happen. In these days, congressmen had other jobs. Many of them were lawyers in their states. Might want to get back, do a little work. But to steal the resolve of the Whigs, there's something here. Not only just a old, respected member of the House to guide them, but a former president of the United States, now an elected congressman from Massachusetts, John Quincy Adams. After 3 days of doing nothing, and even one of the Democrats say, "We are not a Congress, we are a mob," Quincy Adams stands up and says, talking from his table. Now, let's lay the scene here. Prior to the Congress having 435 members and establishing that people will sit down in seats, there were tables. But not everybody got a table because it wasn't big enough. So you had some members, more established members, like Adams, of course, would have a table. And then others would just be kind of walking around or standing, listening to others speak. You have this kind of mix of people talking and roaming and mulling. Adams starts to talk, and an ex-president of the United States can get a crowd listening to him, whatever party he's from. So here, even though he has no right as he's not speaker, John Quincy Adams starts speaking, and he says, "Look at us. We are the representatives of the people, the vice regents of the American people. And this clerk dares to usurp the throne and put us in contempt? Adams gets the attention of the House. I don't like all this mulling. Someone shouts, "Well, who will put the question?" Quincy Adams says, "I will." It's a gamble, it really is, but it pays off because Robert Rhett of South Carolina, not a political supporter of Adams at all, a Democrat, rises up and says, "Okay, I propose we have a solution here. Let the oldest member of the House, and that is currently a man named Lewis Williams of North Carolina, become temporary speaker." I mean, he has no enemies, Williams. He's older, and he'd be fair. But Williams refuses. So then Rhett says, "Fine, let's make Adams temporary, what he calls the chairman of the House." There is no such position. There has been no such position before. There has been no such position since. But this crowd, not exactly a Congress, creates this position for Adams and elects him chairman of the House of Representatives on a temporary basis. Obviously, with the Whigs and the Democrats behind this, Garland, the clerk, is squashed as Congress starts operating, Adams presiding. It still takes a bunch of votes to decide what to do here, and they decide to simply table the New Jersey delegation till they can elect a speaker. Okay, well, this is good for Democrats because Democrats have a majority without those Whigs coming in from New Jersey. But the problem is Democrats are not unified. They try behind Jones of Virginia. They try behind Lewis of Alabama. Each of them gets a few people in the Democratic Party that just don't like them and absolutely adamantly will not vote for them. And the reasons are many. Some of them are personal, but a lot of it has to do with North and South. It's 11 ballots. And the Democrats basically turn to Adams and the Whigs and put their hands in the air. "Look, we're not going to elect a Whig. We're not going to keep Adams there forever. But let's elect somebody that you guys on our side, that you guys can tolerate." And after searching, they find a member, a 30-year-old, Robert Hunter of Virginia. He's young, so he hasn't done anything to offend anyone. But he's also pledged to his constituents not to be for either party when he was elected. "I do not acknowledge," he says, "an allegiance with either of the two great parties in this country." Hunter becomes speaker. He is to this date the youngest speaker of the House of Representatives ever at 30 years old. What about Clerk Garland? Actually, he doesn't get fired. And eventually, the New Jersey delegation is seated. And for this reason, I'll take a little side trip to the history of the Great Seal War of New Jersey. Now, this is obviously, you can tell, an episode about close Congresses. I might call this close encounters of the Congress kind, when the parties are very close, because we obviously are heading into a Congress where the two parties are going to be very close. As I'm recording this, it could be 3, 4, 5, 6 seats apart. Probably 4, but who knows? One of the closest ever, okay? One of the closest ever. You're going to have to go back, as we'll talk, into Woodrow Wilson's time to get something this close. But again, you know, we just had a Congress that's close. So we'll be talking about close moments. And this 26th Congress is one of them. So back to my side trip about the Great Seal War of New Jersey. And the Seal War is so important to American history that I had no idea about it. Even as a New Jerseyan, had no idea about it until the research for this episode. It involves this 1838 midterm election and who New Jersey will send to Congress. Will it be Whigs? Will it be Republicans? There are 6 seats. New Jersey has double that now, so now New Jersey has 12. But this time it had 6 seats. Before they're sent to Congress, their election must be certified, in a sense, with the governor's seal. The seal of New Jersey is the same as the flag of New Jersey, and it's got 2 women, one woman holding on a pole a hat, just looks like kind of like a hat you would wear in winter where it's cold, and the other one holding a cornucopia. They symbolize liberty and prosperity. The hat is a symbol of liberty. The middle of the seal has a horse head at the top, and a helmet at the bottom. Three plows within a shield. The plows indicate the agricultural strength of New Jersey. It's still to this day called the Garden State. The horse head and the helmet are connected. In other words, the helmet symbolizes the control that the people have over the state, the way that the rider would have over the horse. That's the flag of New Jersey. Of course, I remember John Stewart joking that you guys in New Jersey, even your flag has a horse's head, you know. Even your flag has a horse's head, you know, referring to the Godfather movie. Look, I mean, what does it all matter? Until that great seal is affixed on the election, they don't have it. So Governor William Pennington, who is a Whig, decides that he will just say there are six Whigs going to Congress. When the committee formed by Congress to decide whether to seat these members from New Jersey, which, by the way, Adams is part of, looks into it, they find that really just one Whig won his election, got more votes than the Democrats. There were some irregularities in a town called South Amboy in New Jersey, but it's nothing that can be firmly established by the House in a concrete way enough. And so it's decided that they will seat the five Democrats and the one Whig. Control of the House is continued by the Democrats. It won't last long. In the very next election, the Whigs will take over. And Robert Hunter will win his re-election to Congress, the young speaker, but he won't be elected speaker again. Instead, Kentucky's John White, a Whig, will become speaker. Robert Hunter goes on. He, you know, since he's a young person as speaker in the 1830s here, he's going to go on to serve in Grover Cleveland's administration in the 1880s. Not too much to say about him. John White's speakership will be uncontroversial, but it'll only last 2 years and Whigs will lose the House. He'll no longer be speaker. And he's speaking, defending his idol, Henry Clay of Kentucky, also a Whig, on the House floor. The new speaker tries to limit his remarks. Former Speaker White takes umbrage to this, keeps speaking, and a Democratic congressman tells him to be quiet. The speaker told you to stop talking. White says he won't be talked to that way, and the two start trading blows. A dozen congressmen run and jump in the middle, pulling them apart. It's a melee on the floor, and somebody fires a pistol, not in the air, but into the crowd. It hits not any of the offending fighters, but a Capitol policeman. This shocks everyone. Both the former speaker and the other congressman are censured by the House and forced to apologize. I mean, it won't shock that a few of the closest congresses and closest and most contentious speaker elections and in general contentiousness on the House floor happens during the run-up to the Civil War. I mean, it's not just North and South, but that is certainly a big factor. It's also parties. People feel really strongly about their parties as well as their geography, Whig versus Democrat. Tariff issues, banking issues, very important at this time. So such is the case 10 years later, when Congress assembles to form the 31st Congress. Right after the Mexican War, Zachary Taylor's president, 1849, there are 112 Democrats, 105 Whigs, and 13 free soilers. They are adamantly against slavery. It's also true, as Robert Remeni writes in the House, the 31st Congress were young. More than half the members were freshmen. New York's delegation, for example, included 22 first-term representatives out of 34 men. The average age was 43, and only two members were over 62. All of which, since many of them were fire-breathing hotheads, guaranteed trouble. Trouble came instantly. No sooner had they convened when the House quarreled about naming a speaker. Not only did neither party have a majority, but again, we'll go to the totals here of the parties officially on paper. 112 Democrats, 105 Whigs, 13 free soilers. So the first thing you think, well, the Democrats have the most. Yes, but they don't have a majority. And you need a majority to elect a speaker under normal circumstances. Or you could say, well, the Whigs have 105 and the free soilers have 13. So if they combine, they're more than the Democrats. This is true. There would be 118 in that scenario. But that's not going to happen because not all of the Whigs support the Free Soiler. Some of them are Southern Whigs. In fact, among the Whigs, there's an attempt by Robert Toombs and Alexander Stevens of Georgia, both Southern Whigs, to get the whole Whig Party, North and South, to promise that the party will not impose the Wilmot Proviso. The Wilmot Proviso, by Congressman David Wilmot, was a proposal in 1846 that the United States Congress ban slavery in anything they get from the Mexican War. Toombs and Stevens want the whole Whig Party to commit to it. They refuse. They then walk out of the party and take other Southern Whigs with them. So you don't have party unity among the Whigs. But there's not a lot among the Democrats either, who were also split between Northern and Southern Democrats. 11 people end up running for Speaker. During the talks on the House floor, during these many, many ballots that occur, Toombs threatens disunion. If you keep us as enemies, I am for disunion. The Whigs, particularly Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, who's going to play a greater role in the run-up to the Civil War, opposes him. And they're just, he expresses his irritation at this talk of disunion because you disagree. But then Alexander Stevens, who everyone knows is more of a moderate, in fact, he's got a friend. He was friendly with that, that one-termer from Illinois, Abraham Lincoln, at one point. He says in a nicer way, actually, I agree with Toombs. We will not submit to degradation here. There's a lot of tumult over this, and people feel they're playing the victim card, and they feel like they're being simply outnumbered. Clerk is snapping, the clerk is trying to get order, and order, it's bedlam. 3 weeks go on. There's one ballot, no winner. Third, no winner. Fourth, fifth, William Dewar of New York calls Richard Meade, a Virginian, a disunionist during the debate. That's false, Meade says. Dewar says, you are a liar. Meade rushes at Dewar, but people get in between. So you have a congressman from Virginia and one from New York. This is 10 years before the Civil War, almost getting into blows. They do break it up. Everybody's got derringers. There are more of these derringers named after a Philadelphia gunsmith, pocket revolvers in the House than there are desks for members. And it's at this point, Nathan Sargent, nice name for someone who is the sergeant at arms, knows what to do. He picks up the House mace, the ornamented mace that symbolizes the power of the House of Representatives, and just lifts it up and walks through the floor with it. He doesn't plan to hit anybody or anything. It's just kind of like a symbol. And someone says, they shouted at him, take that away. It has no place here. It is. It's supposed to be a symbol of power, not an actual weapon. It's not a weapon for the sergeant at arms to use against people. But it does calm the mood and the disarray, and Meade does challenge Dewar to a formal duel, but it just never happens. That's just in the middle of the balloting, though. There's 41 ballots, and now there are 30 different people running. You know, think about that for a second, because at this time, that means that there's like one out of every 10 people on the House floor is running for Speaker. Then there's 18 more ballots. Finally, a member from Alabama, Democrat, gets up and says, look, let's try 3 more votes. And if we can't get a Speaker in 3 more votes, can we just decide, instead of a majority, whoever gets the plurality wins? It's not how it works. That's not House normal rules, but everybody's exhausted and they decide to give it a try. And it's Democrat Howell Cobb that wins the plurality out of Georgia, and he becomes Speaker. Takes 20 more votes to name a clerk, 14 more to name a doorkeeper, and, you know, yet, this very divided House under Cobb, you know, he turns out to be something of a good facilitator of discussion, his meetings at his house, getting people together. People do respect Cobb. He will end up, you know, serving in the Confederacy like most Southerners. You know, it's a rabble bunch that's in Cobb's Congress, and Daniel Webster says of the 31st, every man in the House speaks to defend himself and his own district and gratify constituents. That's all. There's no national speeches in that House. And it's true. But this is the House that passes the Great Compromise coming from the Senate. California's added to the Union, and elected representatives are already there waiting to join the 31st Congress as soon as they take their seats. 31st, the 34th, the 36th Congress, all before the Civil War, take forever to name speakers. In the latter 36th Congress, Republicans, know-nothings, and Democrats, this is 1859, John Brown's raid has just occurred. The South is frightened. The people in Congress believe that the North is whooping up people like John Brown to come down and encourage slave revolts and attack them. Something else. A book called The Impending Crisis of the South, Hinton R. Helpers, is just as stirring as Harriet Beecher's Uncle Tom's Cabin in terms of a book bestseller, stirring up controversy, and you could say developing a voice for the Union cause during the run-up to the Civil War. Its publication in 1857 has real impact. It's used as it'll be used in a couple of years for Abraham Lincoln's campaign in 1860. You know, things will be taken right out of the message, right out of the impending crisis, and put into the Republican 1860 platform. It calls for the abolition of slavery and the modernization of the South. Helper argues, slavery's the biggest obstacle to Southern economic growth. This institution, your peculiar institution, makes you poor, ignorant, and superstitious. And he encouraged non-slaveholding whites to look out for the interest. Stop letting that small percentage of people who own slaves in the South, stop letting them tell you what to do. He also criticizes, and this is a common criticism at the time, Lincoln would make several of these type of criticisms, that the elite in the South downplay the importance of labor, of manual labor, of doing work. And they treat non-slaveholding whites as badly as they treat people who are enslaved, Helper pointing out. They duped them into believing that the peculiar institution benefited them when it didn't. He says that in a century or two, it's actually a long time, after slavery's abolition, the South would emerge as one of the greatest cosmopolitan civilizations that had ever lived. So, and he writes this before John Brown, but it's fueling this debate. And you can see, like, Helper's tone here is kind of like, hey, I want to help you out, but when in rhetoric have you ever seen people really respond well to that? Like, I'm just trying to help you out with what you can do better in your region. Didn't respond well. You know, in reality, at face value, Helper makes some great points. But the impending crisis is very controversial, and it comes smack in the middle of this speaker's election. Again, there are Southern congressmen who will say, if you do not give us our rights, we are for disunion. And Thaddeus Stevens gets up again. This is, you know, years later. He's like, you keep coming up with these threats. They're empty threats, Stevens says, and it's only because there's a few Northerners foolish enough to listen to you. We won't anymore. So neither side is listening to each other. And in this Congress, there won't be any solution like that last one where they went for a plurality vote as Speaker. No, no side wants it. It's North versus South in a sense, and they want a majority.
Hello all, Eric Rivenis with the Most Notorious Podcast here. Each week I interview an author or historian about a historical true crime, tragedy, or disaster. Subject matter ranges from gunslingers to Gilded Age murder to gangsters to fires to pirates to wild prison breaks. My guests bring their incredible knowledge directly to you. Please subscribe to Most Notorious on your favorite podcast app. Cheers, and have a safe tomorrow.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places: Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan. But nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
And here's the thing. So you've got... Now, first of all, you got to understand it's a little bit difficult to name parties right here in 1859 because you have the Republican Party that starts in 1854, but not everyone uses that label. There's a variety of terms. You might be anti-Nebraskan, might still use the term Whig. And there are know-nothings that sort of play in the Republican camp. But it starts out like this. There are 115 Republicans of some sort named to Congress. There are 5 know-nothings. There are something like 28 between Southern Whigs, know-nothings, you know, not really having much of a label. And then Democrats are split, where there's at least 14 Democrats that are against the administration of Buchanan and 83 that are for him. So it's really a confusing picture here. But the Republicans should be in the majority, but do not have enough seats to get a majority quite there yet. They need 118 congressmen to vote for speaker. They're getting something like 115. Their candidate that they want to back is John Sherman of Ohio, brother to the future Civil War general. The trouble is John Sherman has endorsed the impending crisis. And so they go vote after vote after vote. And there's also a few know-nothings that don't like him very much. Sherman's not in support of some of their policies. Sherman's getting the second largest number of votes on the first ballot, but no one's getting a majority. Southerners are saying, look, you endorsed this book, The Impending Crisis. Sherman actually ends up saying, no, I didn't do this. I merely endorsed the concept of free speech and his chance to write it. This is not believed. There's 2 months of balloting to try to find a speaker. Finally, someone comes up with that plurality idea. It's rejected. No, we need a majority. So what to do? They said, look, we can't get Sherman through because of his name and the association with the impending crisis. But we do have this Republican from New Jersey. He's just elected for the first time, so he's a freshman member. He hasn't said anything to offend anyone. He's in favor of the fugitive slave law, at least as he believes it's part of the Constitution and it's stated law. He hasn't done anything to upset the know-nothings. And oh, by the way, his name is William Pennington. Yes, the governor from our story earlier is now a freshman member of the House of Representatives from New Jersey. So they make him speak. But basically, he gets all of his instructions from John Sherman, who he immediately places on the important appropriation committee. He's not a great speaker, Pennington. New Jersey independents and Democrats in his district feel like he's just become a partisan Republican, and they will vote him out in 2 years. It's the first time a sitting Speaker of the House will lose election. In her book, Field of Blood, Violence in Congress, Joanne B. Freeman writes about this 36th Congress that Speaker Pennington will sort of lead. All told, there were more than a dozen fights in the 36th Congress, as well as many near misses. One congressman, John Potter, earned the name Bowie Knife Potter. Potter defended a congressman who was speaking out against slavery. Democrats felt the congressman was getting too close and waving his arms in the direction of the Democrats. They took offense, and a Roger Pryor of Virginia, known to be a bit of a bully, runs down. Potter stands in his stead. Let him speak. He has the right to speak. See, this is happening as you get into the 1840s and 1850s. You know, it's kind of like the movie My Bodyguard. People have members of Congress that they know are good fighters. Galusha Grow of Pennsylvania, who will be speaker later during the Civil War, you know, he's known to be a guy like you're not going to mess with. It's kind of like on the hockey teams. You have that kind of, is it Bobby Orr? Do I have that right? The enforcer guys. that are like, don't mess with my team. You mess with them, you're going to get me. Roscoe Conkling, this is one of the things that he's known for. This is what occurs. Nobody's said anything to Potter, but Potter steps down in defense. Well, Pryor challenges him to a duel. Potter says, okay, I'll select the weapons. Because you challenged me, I get to select the weapons. My weapon will be Bowie knives. Roger Pryor, of course, the congressman, and his seconds are like, no, we'd rather do pistols, and no, that's rejected. And eventually there's no duel, but Potter has stood up to them. It's the same thing that Galusha Grow does in different occasions. When he's challenged, Grow will say, if you want to fight me, we'll fight out in the street. I don't want a duel. And that usually was good enough to stave off some of these duels when people knew that they were good, strong men and fighters versus taking your chance with maybe hitting them with a pistol. So thanks to the House.gov website, we have an indication of what speakers' elections were decided by multiples ballots. And that's actually one of the last ones was the one where William Pennington was picked as speaker in the 36th Congress. 44 ballots. The 34th goes for 133rd. That is 133. That's the record. So you really only have 14 that are decided by multiple ballots. And the last one's 1925. And there's not a heck of a lot of controversy over Frederick Huntington Gillett. There was no gunshots or brawling in the Congress in 1923, but there was a bit of a political brawl between the progressives and the Republicans. Both major party nominees initially failed to gain a majority because of votes cast for other members, members from the Progressive Party or from the progressive wing of the Republican Party. Many of these members agreed to vote for the Republican candidate only on the ninth ballot, after the Republican leadership had agreed to accept a number of procedural reforms that the members favored. You just see that getting settled in the 20s, where it's like, no, we're going to be largely a more conservative party with this little progressive wing, but a lot of you progressives can go take a hike. That was one of the battles that gets that settled. The next will be the next year, 1924, when, you know, there's an actual split and the Progressive Party runs against Coolidge and doesn't get a lot of votes. Then Coolidge can consolidate more among Republicans. We don't have a second ballot for a speaker's election after that. People like Sam Rayburn or Joseph Martin or Carl Albert are decided on ahead of time and elected. Why are we talking about this? Well, you know why, because for the first time you might. I mean, as I'm recording this, there's some politics going on. It's not clear how many seats the GOP will have in majority. It could be anywhere from 3 to 5. There are at least, as I'm recording, because things can change, 5 that don't want to elect Kevin McCarthy from California, the current Republican leader, to the speakership. If that continues to the speaker's vote, he will not be elected speaker. There's no plurality here. You must get a majority. So, in fact, if they were for some reason to vote for a Democrat, there would be a Democratic speaker. Sounds crazy? It would be crazy. It really hasn't happened except in the multi-party days that I talked about there, where you kind of put an independent in or a Republican we agree with in. But hasn't happened in the House of Representatives where you've had, like, the Republicans win, but they put a Democrat in as speaker. That hasn't happened in any kind of modern sense of the two parties and in any kind of modern time. You have seen it in some states. Willie Brown in California was able to become speaker even after a disastrous election by wooing a couple of Republican members. Thomas Kane in the 1974 New Jersey Assembly. This is before Thomas Kane became governor. Becomes Speaker of the House even though his party is short. And the reason he does is because Jersey City Democrats don't agree with the state Democratic Party's choice for Speaker of the New Jersey Assembly. So Kane's able to get with those New Jersey reform Democrats and a Republican becomes Speaker just for a quick time. The dispute had to do with, Jersey City was a rigid kind of political machine. And in fact, the person leading that machine would end up being indicted several years later. You know, so it has happened at the state level where you've had this kind of like mix it up. A party wins the majority, but can't actually the other party becomes speaker. It's rare because you're talking about all policy control stemming from the speaker. Speaker's going to have a big role in appointing committee heads, not the total role, a big role in the number of people on the rules committee, and the ability to hear or not hear, and recognize or not recognize bills moving forward. In addition to their kind of psychological power as the leader, why would you want to, as a party, give that up? So it's not going to happen that you could pull a Willie Brown here. But what is possible is that if there's only three or four seats, so you'll have, say, Hakeem Jeffries as one choice, McCarthy as another choice, and then 5, 6, 7, whatever, Bolt, there is no speaker. We'll have a second ballot for the first time since 1923. Maybe they're able to convince some people. Like, for instance, and this is me just doing some political hypotheticals here. For instance, if you have Trump come out for McCarthy and say, look, guys, it's unpatriotic or unparty, you know, it's against me not to vote for McCarthy right now. Yeah, I have my disagreements with him, blah, 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 blah. You know, something like that. That could be a factor where the screws are put on those five people or just within the House. McCarthy can say, look, I'm going to get this thing. One of these five are going to break, or three of these five are going to break, and the other two I'm going to punish. I mean, that kind of thing goes on in the back rooms. It's risky because you could lose it. And what will happen is if it's second ballot, third ballot, I don't think you're going to suffer through 115 ballots in 2022. I don't think that happens. It's too embarrassing. It's bad for the party. It's just going to be two or three ballots. That would be the maximum. And McCarthy's eventually going to have to step down in favor of some compromise candidate who will be a Republican. Now, you can see how incredibly weak that person will be as a speaker, not having had even the leadership.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. Today could be the day a famous mobster met their end, or the first milestone for humans in space. Who knows what history today holds? Find out when you listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
A couple of things. To be fair, there's so much talk about how close this new Congress coming in will be. But to be fair, the 117th Congress, 222 Democrats and 212 Republicans, so it's only a 10-seat difference. It's not impossible on a lot of pieces of legislation to get 10. Pelosi's been very disciplined and been able to work with the different groups to get legislation. Indeed, the average difference between the two parties is 61 seats. You usually have 61 since the beginning of the Republic, 61 seats between the two major parties. Actually, since the House has increased to 435 members, it's got more distance. It's been 95 on average since 1911. So this makes even the last Congress extraordinary with 10 seats. And if you're going to bring that down to, say, 4 or 5, that's a big difference. So expect to see some things that we're not used to. I referenced Tom Kane, the former governor of New Jersey, somebody who I have to admit I've always had a lot of respect for. His son is now entering Congress. And he's supportive of McCarthy, certainly. He's expressed that. He's made his peace, let's say, with President Trump, but he's not going to be extreme. You have some congressmen in New York, Lawler. You have a congressman in California reelected who voted to impeach Trump. You've got about five or six moderates there that you could put in the category, say, of a Kessinger or a Liz Cheney almost. They're just not as well known. Where if things get too extreme, they might bail out. And it's not just what they want to do. They're in districts that voted for Biden, and they are going to have tougher races in a presidential election year and going to have to show their districts that they're very bipartisan and everything like that. And guess what? There's a number of Democratic congressmen who are eager and willing to help because they're in districts that had a big Trump vote. So they're going to want to show their bipartisanness. So there's a lot there. That's going to be a factor. You have the Freedom Caucus. You have kind of members right now being supportive of McCarthy, but probably itching to rebel at some point. Matt Gaetz, who has said he's not going to support him at all. It's just a lot going on there. It's going to be a tough Congress to manage. Very different, very far from that 61 average that you get. When was the last time we had a really close Congress? Not recently. Not recently at all. A little bit, you could say the 106th, which was 1999 to 2000, right after Clinton's surprise 1998 midterm. And there you had a difference of just 12 seats. The one before it was just 19 seats, but, you know, didn't have the Senate as you do now. So Clinton wasn't able to do too much with that. He did get some things done at the end of his administration. Something to delve in a little bit more. We got a lot of small issues. Budget issues taken care of. The differences are like 26, 82, 100, 85, 81. You know, big differences between the parties as normal. You got a little tightness in the 85th Congress under Eisenhower, 1957 to 1959. There's 29 seats difference. Still not going to affect too much. During World War II, you had a 13-seat difference between the parties. But the closest one you get is 72nd, 1931 to 1932. So in the 1930 midterms, the Republicans get more seats, but just by two. And guess what? During that Congress, two people die. Two congressmen die. They happen to be Republicans, and they are replaced by Democrats in their elections. And John Nance Gardner becomes Speaker. The closest one, and the closest Congress ever, is the 65th Congress. There are 214 Democrats, 215 Republicans, so technically Republicans have more. There are three progressives, an independent, a prohibitionist, and a socialist. With those votes, the Democrats are able to retain control of Congress. Beauchamp Clark remains Speaker. This is under Woodrow Wilson's administration. Interesting, as close as this Congress is, this will be the Congress that commits us to World War I. And that issue will be divisive, but the vote for war will be overwhelming despite opposition. And it doesn't reflect this closeness of Congress. But there are differences of opinion. In fact, Beauchamp Clark is no supporter of World War I. Our entry into World War I does not support a draft bill after the declaration of war. This Congress, the 65th, will be significant for the first woman elected, Jeanette Rankin of Montana. And there's an interesting thing that happened. She's the first woman in Congress. There's a lot of press around her. And it comes time to vote for war. And they name, you know, Congresswoman Rankin. And she doesn't say yay or nay. You don't have to because there's two roll calls in Congress. At least at this time. She knows she can wait, so she waits. She doesn't vote on the first one. But during that time, she's approached by a man from Illinois, an older man, and it's Joe Cannon, the former Speaker of the House during Teddy Roosevelt's time, and now just a member of Congress. sitting back watching it. He says, little lady, kind of a little patronizing there, but he does mean something more than just that. Little lady, you cannot be silent. You are speaking for your whole gender right now. You cannot be silent. Vote yes, vote no. I'm not going to tell you how to vote, but you cannot not vote. And when the roll call comes back, she votes no against entry to World War II. This is attacked, and there are even some women groups. They're like, oh, great, you know, we're trying to get the right to vote, and now the first one to vote is playing into some stereotypes that we're all pacifists and things like that. Nonetheless, that's such a vote. Indeed, Rango will actually be the only member to vote against entry to World War II as well, even after Pearl Harbor. Now, this is an extraordinary vote for her. She is a committed pacifist. But in any case, that 65th Congress that is organized in 1917 is the closest between two major parties that you get. You know, again, it's highly unusual. There are about three or four where you even have a difference of less than 20. It is highly unusual to have just four or five seats separating the Congress. Incidentally, the one where you do is one of the first, three Congresses are pretty close. It's 9-9 and then 3 between what you would say administration or anti-administration or Federalist and Republican. But, you know, these differences are assigned by historians later based on their voting and their caucusing. It's hard to tell where you are in these early parties. But that's the funny thing about it. The first Congress is pretty close between the parties. It's 65 members of the House at that time in 1789. And there's 37 that are kind of pro-Washington and 28 that are more, say, Republican or anti-administration. Goes to 39-30 and then goes to 51-54, where the anti-administration, mostly led by James Madison, corralling them in the House, actually have majority. And that's when you see the fight over the treaty with Britain, the Jay Treaty. Three-seat difference between the parties, although, again, you know, Madison never has a total control the way a party does now. There's not the kind of whipping. Suffice it to say, if it's three or four, you've got that 1793 Congress. You've got the 19th Congress, which takes place during John Quincy Adams' presidency with a difference of five. You have the 30th. During the Mexican War and the 31st, where you have five or six difference between the two parties. Then you get to the 65th, we just talked about during World War I, with a one-seat difference. The 1930, we referenced, with a two-seat difference, which turns into a Democratic advantage. And nothing comes close. There is nothing else where it's less than five separating the two major parties in Congress. There you have it. So expect the unexpected, I guess is what I would say. Like, expect to see some things that you're not used to, maybe some pulling. There is also something else that you could discuss, and that's advanced whipping methods, so that, in other words, the chains are much stronger. After you get to, let's say, the 1960s, you start with a more advanced whipping system where you actually have deputy whips and lots of them, to the point where there's deputy whips. It's more like, think of it like a multi-level marketing network. You know, so each, you may have a whip for every three or four congressperson, which means there's somebody respond. If you let them down and don't vote the way the party votes, that's like one person that's responsible for your vote you're letting down. You have to inform them quick. You have to give the party a chance to, and the speaker a chance to talk to you about what your objections are. You know, it's not just like, this isn't just like they wait and surprise, surprise, you know, but so the much more advanced whipping methods than you had. So that's a counter to what could happen. You can keep people on choke chains, but that requires party discipline. And you had more of it, say, when Newt Gingrich was leader, and, you know, and there was like, wow, we were brought to victory. Then you're going to have over a speaker that's either a much weaker midterm than was expected, so not as much of a rally, or some speaker who's a compromise we don't even know yet, and they won't know yet. Very little loyalty to them. Expect the unexpected as we move forward. Hope you enjoyed this about the Congress, close encounters of the Congress kind on My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. Do you like the show? Tell someone about it. This show only spreads with word of mouth. I don't have a lot of money to spend on advertising or things like that. Very pleased to be part of Airwave Media Network, and there's some great shows on there. I don't have a big Hollywood machine behind me or something like that. We rely on you. Please tell someone about it wherever you can, just on your social media, on your blog, just talking to friends about what podcast you listen to. All of that helps. You know, when I get a listener, sometimes they last a very long time. Shout out to Kevin Willis, one of my original listeners, who got his mom listening, and she continues to listen as she travels the world. Really pleased with things like that. Review if you can on Apple Podcasts is the best, but also Podcast Addict. I could use reviews there. Or Overcast, I could use reviews there. Please give a good review if you like it. And then also if you're in one of those apps where you can vote helpful other reviews, that helps a lot too. Every once in a while, somebody sneaks in a little agenda with a review and it's not a real review of the program, and only like unhelpful votes will get that to the place it belongs. I want to thank you for listening.